hello, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
Today, we are going to continue our mythology series with a couple of awesome episodes. I'm really excited about this one, Jen. We are going to be talking today about EBE, one of your favorites.
Yeah!
And the Erlenmeyer Flask, which is the season one finale. But before we get into that, Jen, are you ready to read some tweets of the week?
Time for some tweets.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are in response to our interview with Judd Trichter from a couple of weeks ago. Judd, of course, was a guest star playing Richie in the episodes Requiem and This Is Not Happening. And he was so very gracious with his time with us, and we really enjoyed chatting with him. And some folks had some really interesting comments to make on that. Kathy G said, such a fun interview. I loved all the stories, and I just ordered Judd's book. So, boom. Nice little turnaround there for Judd. At least one book got sold because of our podcast, which is making me happy.
Well, and I mean, Judd is a great... too, so.
Oh, you have it too. All right. I should get it too. Yes. Then we've got at least three.
Yeah.
I mean, it does sound like a really cool book. You know, if you haven't heard the podcast, first of all, go back and listen to it. But Judd is a very talented guy, and he's an author of fiction as well. And he does cool sort of sci-fi stuff, and it sounds really, really interesting stuff. So check him out. Check out his book. It sounds awesome. From MSR or Bust, which I love as a username. Thank you for this treat. Judd's story about Jillian's behind-the-scenes antics had me smiling all the way to work, which doesn't happen often. Ugh, I hear you. Mm-hmm. It makes you wonder what went on with the main cast, particularly Robert, since they got on so well. The truth is out there. It surely, surely is. And Rusting Willpower retweeted us. Thanks for the retweet, by the way, saying this episode has one of the greatest behind the scenes stories I've ever heard. So I'm just guessing that's the same story about Jillian trying to mess around with Judd by making sexually suggestive comments.
I mean, I was going to say the car story. That was my...
Well, the car story is great, too.
I mean, I would like Rusting Willpower to let us know which story they are referring to, because that was the one I thought, but we'll see.
That was a great...
There were so many good stories on this interview.
He was, like, full of great stories and so very sort of, like, chill and willing to tell them, which I was really glad about.
Yeah.
But that was a great tweet, a great tease for the podcast to sort of just introduce it that way, because then everyone had to listen to it to find out what it was. So I thought that was great. From Call Me Scully, Call Me Scully recreates a small portion of the podcast saying, Judd, Sunday nights were off limits because that was the night she watched The X-Files with her vibrator. Talking of his lady friend there, to which Annie responds, that is the most relatable story I've ever heard anybody tell on this podcast. And then Colby Scully says, this is podcast gold, people. And yes, so relatable. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally agree with that. And Monica agrees with that, too. Monica said, quoting, she pleasured herself to David Duchovny every Sunday night. Fucking relatable, but also with Gillian Anderson, of course. Of course, Monica, you know it, sister. I just had to give a little shout out to Lenka. I'm not sure which episode she was referring to necessarily with this tweet, but I wanted to put it in anyway, because she deserves credit for saying this on January 1st. When you're trying to exercising on New Year's Day, that's like wow. Mega points, like New Year's resolution or not. That is like impressive that you're exercising on January 1st when I like barely got out of bed. When you're trying to exercise and listen to the XFD podcast at the same time, but you can't really because you're laughing your ass off. Not that I'm complaining, girls. Thanks, Lenka. Thanks for referring to me as a girl. I genuinely appreciate it. At some point in my life, I reached the age when being referred to as a girl was a fucking delight. So thanks for that. I appreciate it. And we appreciate all your tweets. Thanks, guys. As always, did you have anything specific or in general that you wanted to say in response to those tweets, Annie?
Oh my God, no. I was just cracking up at how many people were writing in how relatable the David Duchovny vibrator story was, because that was probably one of my favorite moments on the podcast.
I still can't believe it all happened. You just never know what kind of interesting conversations we'll wind up having on this podcast. And it's amazing. The X-Files touches people in so many different ways.
So many ways. Somewhat related, Judd, if you ever want to come back, you are welcome to come back and tell us as many stories as you want. Heck, you can tell us stories about anything.
Yeah.
We'll listen to your story. So thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for coming. And, you know, for anyone that's ever joined us, we so appreciate it. And yeah, Judd, come back on, talk about your book again. Look how many sales you've got, at least 3 already. That's got to be a start. And yeah, thanks again for joining us in the first place. So we love talking X-Files with anyone that wants to talk about X-Files with us. And that's what we do around here. So, and if you'd like to talk about X-Files on Twitter, tweet at us at XFD Podcast. And we love hearing from you. We love chatting with you. And everybody else on Twitter likes talking about the X-Files too, because it's awesome. So thanks, everybody.
Mold of the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen. Back to our mythology journey. Is that what we're calling it?
I feel like I'm on a journey, actually.
I do feel like
maybe it's a quest.
It is a quest for the truth, because that's what we're trying to do here. A quest to weave it all together. The first thing I wanted to ask you before we get into this is that, do you feel like at this point, after having watched season one, that you still have a pretty good grasp on kind of what's going on the X-Files?
I think I do. Mm-hmm. I did. I certainly felt like that at the time when I was watching it. I feel like I have a grasp on what I'm meant to have a grasp on.
Right.
There are some things I don't quite understand yet, but I'm pretty sure I'm not meant to necessarily, and that's okay. And there's still a few things that I'm slightly fuzzy on, but it didn't bother me at the time, although I'm starting to wonder now if mild fuzziness early on turned into major fuzziness later on, and that maybe if I am sure to kind of get everything down pat as best as I can as I go this time, it will serve me better in the long term as well, because I am really starting to recognize how much long-term stuff actually showed up in season one. And we'll talk about that, I think.
That's what I'm excited to talk about that, because I feel like season one, especially, I know the revival is going to come up today, but I feel like they went back, they dug back way, way back into season one with some revival stuff, and we will be talking about that. But
great, and I'd forgotten a lot of the kind of specifics of some of these. I mean, I've seen these episodes many times, but a lot of the times I'm just not paying close attention to the specifics of the mythology, because, you know, I'm like, yeah, mythology, I know all that stuff. Clearly, I do not. So.
Isn't David so pretty? Yeah, I get it.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's hard.
Like,
it's hard.
Oh, man, like, what was happening with Scully's bangs in this episode and things like that?
But, I still find new things. Every time I watch it, I still will like, shit, that was cool. That was a new little thing that they brought up.
I mean, watching these episodes specifically with sort of an eye to the mythology gives me definitely a different impression, too.
That's true. I mean, we are watching them, like, on purpose, paying attention to the mythology. I feel like a lot of the time when I watch the show, I kind of allow myself to drift, and I allow myself to wander to David's bottom lip. And it happens. It happens.
Yes.
But in this, you know, we're actually paying attention and we're doing our homework, and it's awesome. So episode 17, EBE. The director was William Graham, and this is a Morgan and Wong script.
Nice. Boom.
Yeah. They obviously have already written some. I know they did Beyond the Sea and probably several more, right?
They did Squeeze as well. And Tombs comes after this, I think. Mm-hmm. And Ice, I believe, was theirs as well.
Yeah.
And they did one of the ones that was slightly not great. I can't remember if it was Shadows or Shapes. I always get those two mixed up. But for the most part, brilliant episodes. I mean, in the early days, this was like pre-Darren Morgan, pre-Vince Gilligan. Back in these days, we were just like always every episode crossing our fingers, hoping to see Morgan and Wong's name come up, because they were the writers that we were often fans of.
Yeah. I mean, in this one, I think in particular, and we'll talk about this because I know this is one of your favorite episodes, but I feel like this is a really huge turning point in the Mulder-Scully relationship.
Yep.
And we're not going to focus on that today, but we'll definitely bring it up. because I do think it's important, even in terms of moving the mythology forward.
Yeah, so, it's all interconnected to some extent, right? The mythology and Mulder and Scully's relationship. That's why the MSR is so awesome. It's not just because it's hot, but also because it is interwoven with the show and it underlies the theme of the show. And I love all of that. So
the way that it's doled out is so
yeah,
nice.
That's right. It's sort of like the mythology that way. Little dribs and drabs to feed us.
Yes. And they do feed us well, I think.
They do. I mean, it's there when you're sort of looking for it. I mean, this was season one and there's a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff we got in both of these episodes. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot to chew over. I mean, otherwise the show never would have caught on because, you know, people from the beginning were excited about the show and excited to talk about it. And that's how it generated the buzz that it did, because people were going to work on Mondays and talking about what was happening on Friday on The X-Files. And that's why, because, you know, there was just enough to get you interested and not so much that you didn't still have questions to ask and interest to develop. So they did it right.
They definitely did.
It's for me.
EBE, we start out in Iraq, which I wanted to say, do you happen to remember another mythology episode where Iraq is dealt with off the top of your head?
Bloody hell. It sounds like a familiar concept, but I can't remember which one, but well, I bet you do.
Yeah, I do. Well, they talk a lot about the Gulf War syndrome and how they kind of are relating that to maybe UFO activity and how, you know, all of that stuff. But if you'll remember, let's jump way ahead. I know it's hard to season 9, the episode where we find out sort of about that crazy, wacky cult that cult was and they were sort of originated because they were following the super soldiers. They were like, they saw the super soldiers, which we know also were being developed during the war. We find out later. Obviously, they're not talking about super soldiers in EBE, but it is an interesting kind of connection to know that this stuff is going on in the world at this time. Like, they're doing these experiments, they're having and this was actually witnessed during the Gulf War at some point. I remember there was a flashback in Providence, I believe, or Providence, one of those episodes. Where they talk about it. Anyway,
I don't feel so bad that I forgot now, because anything from season 9 is always a little bit murky in my memory. Yeah. So.
Oh, it absolutely is. You know what, Jen? As you know very well, season 9 is murky in many people's memory. but you know what? We will address that, I promise.
We will.
So I learned something, though, too, because I have never... I'm not a huge UFO buff. I don't know if you ever were, but I did not...
Oh, yeah, I was.
Do you know about this 37th parallel thing?
No, I didn't know about that.
Okay, because apparently the 37th parallel, which is, you know, one of the not the equator, but those lines with the latitude lines or whatever, it travels across the United States in the southern, you know, kind of area, and it goes all the way around, and it covers Iraq, apparently. Like, it goes all the way around. Apparently the 37th parallel is this hotbed for UFO activity, I found really interesting as I was sort of following along EBE. You know, the way that the truck was even traveling was like through Tennessee, and it was through, I mean, eventually it ended up, it was headed towards, I don't remember where it was headed towards, actually.
It was Colorado or something?
It was headed west, correct? Yeah.
Yeah, west.
They eventually, you know, tracked it down closer west. But I did think it was interesting that they were sort of following the 37th parallel, which I would never have thought about if I hadn't looked it up. So
did not know that. I'm learning.
Yeah. So anyway.
That's cool.
We right off the bat get some cool throwback to the pilot with the truck going out. Loss of time, probably. We don't really know exactly what's happening here, other than there's a, you know, some sort of UFO crash. And it's different than what's happening in the pilot, because obviously Mulder and Scully don't come out with, like, you know, radiation poisoning and radiation burns and all this crazy sickness. But I think that what they sort of pull... what they glean from that is that this guy has been doing this route for a long time, and he was also maybe subjected to this over years and years and years of being in the Gulf War and having the Gulf War syndrome, and that was part of the cover-up. Anyway, sorry, I'm going off on a huge tangent, but I thought all of this stuff was super interesting for them to bring up, because I bet at the time, what was this, 93, right?
94.
Probably 94 at this point. That was probably a really sort of topical thing and a fear, something that people could have been genuinely afraid of at the time. So I just thought that was a really interesting thing to talk about.
It was really fascinating, really, and like very sort of topical to talk about Gulf War syndrome, and, you know, UFOs were still, you know, very hot topic at that point as well. So talking about sort of combining those two subjects together made it sort of seem very real, because, you know, Gulf War syndrome was something that was being widely talked about. And then to kind of bring UFOs into that, it makes the UFO seem like more credible and more interesting and more like part of real life as well. So it was cool. It just sort of, you know, Chris Carter always has such a talent for sort of picking out the things that are on people's minds and sort of reflecting those in the episodes. And this is a great example of that.
Right. It does. It's one of those things where it's like you think, oh, I've heard of the Gulf War syndrome. That's a thing that happened. It's like, but why? Oh, what could something weird have caused that? And it does make you think about it. It does make you wonder. And I mean, I think they do a really good job of making it plausible here.
Yeah,
I mean,
like, absolutely.
Even Scully kind of is getting on board with the possibility that there's something going on. And I know I have a lot of things to say about Scully in EBE, which we can get to. But
definitely.
But I wanted to say too, like right off the top, like we find out it's the military. Like when Scully and Mulder are in that holding cell or whatever, and they're interviewing the truck driver, it's the military, right, that come out and tell them to leave.
I thought it was the local, you mean like they're at like the police station or wherever they're at?
Yeah.
I always interpreted that as being, for some reason, a sheriff or a law enforcement officer, but I assumed acting under the behest of the government in some fashion.
Okay. I wanted to check, and I should have gone back and double checked that. I thought that's what it was. But like, I do think it's interesting that they are right off the top setting up like the military. I mean, they already have in Deep Throat. They did too. The military as sort of the ones that are controlling, kind of the puppet masters of all, like they're the ones that are sort of housing all the people that do the dirty work and are covering everything up. And it's interesting too, because you learn that by the end, by the season 9 finale, that we know for sure that they're the ones that are controlling everything, because they're the ones trying to, you know, put Mulder to death and all of that stuff. But it is interesting to see that this early on, it is pretty much it's the syndicate, of course, but the military sort of they're
part of it.
It's like they're dogs. Like they send the dogs off. Like you're gonna go take care of this, because that you can get away with it, because when people are afraid, they let the military do whatever, because they're here to protect us. They're here to serve and protect. So it's a really, really easy thing to believe that, oh, maybe there's something shady going on. And I think that's cool.
And I think that certainly, especially back in the 90s, there was such a mistrust of government at that time, and the military as an extension of that, with lots of reflection on things like the Tuskegee experiments back in World War II, and things that we knew had started to come out, that for a fact the military had been up to some dodgy shit. And so there was a sense, probably more so than now, that you can't trust the military, and that they represent a sort of unknowable force in the government, and that they are somewhat sinister. And so this definitely fit in with that vibe at the time.
Right, right. And it's interesting you bring up the Tuskegee experiments, because I know Mulder, you know, he mentions that among other things later, like among all the other things that, like, if you're watching the show and maybe you're like, what is that? What is that? Oh, what?
Yeah.
What? You know, it's going to make more people like conspiracy theorists, or like not conspiracy theorists, but like look into it and be like, wow, this crazy shit is going on, you know?
Yeah, that was all the whole thing back then. And it was like, you know, sort of, you know, very close to sort of conspiracy theorists like the lone gunman that we may encounter in this episode. Mm-hmm. You know, I find it interesting with the X-Files, when we're talking about the X-Files then and the X-Files in the revival, how much change there was in the connotation of the phrase conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. Because back then it was sort of harmless guys on the internet, mostly guys like the lone gunman, who generally seemed to be trying to find out things that the government were up to that were causing harm to citizens, and seemed to be mostly harmless and with good intentions. And these days, conspiracy theorists, for example, might actually be the president of the United States, and it has a very different sort of political kind of implication now, that it didn't really have a political implication back in the 90s. It was just more about people that were just a little bit offbeat and very skeptical about information that they were given by the government.
Right. I mean, well, the problem is, too, like you said, like when you have the president, you know, dispensing of this stuff, yeah, you're going to have a lot more people believing it. And so it yeah. becomes less of a conspiracy theory, and then it suddenly becomes the truth.
Exactly.
And not to say that conspiracy theories aren't true, because I'm sure many of them are, but the ones that aren't are then dangerously believed to be true, I feel
yeah.
like. So
yeah.
And that's when things get murky, and I feel like that's how they... That's what they were trying to sort of deal with in the revival. And I think that's what made the revival really interesting. But
yeah, that was one of the most fundamental changes, I think, in society, is this change where conspiracy theorists were used to be about sort of holding power accountable. Mm-hmm. And now conspiracy theorists are in power in many cases.
Yes.
And using that power to use conspiracy theories as a weapon. And that's very different than what it used to be back in the 90s, for sure.
Absolutely.
I used to be very quite taken with conspiracy theories in the 90s. Wouldn't have called myself a conspiracy theorist, but I was always very intrigued by the idea of conspiracy theories and read quite a lot about them. So I'm a fan of the 90s brand conspiracy theory types.
Yeah. Well, like the Lone Gunman. We could talk about the Lone Gunman if you want. I mean, we get to meet.
Let's do that.
Yeah. We get to meet Byers, Langley, and Frohickey. This is their first episode.
Yay!
I think it's a great little scene for them. It's like, we get it. And even the way Mulder interacts with them and the way he kind of describes them to Scully, I don't know if they are intended in this episode. I'm curious to hear what you think. If they're intended to be like his friends or more of like colleagues or consults that he uses.
Yeah, I get the impression they're more like colleagues, mm-hmm. but like friendly colleagues, obviously.
Yeah.
But like when you have things like, you know, Byers saying to Mulder things like, this is why we like you, Mulder. Your ideas are even crazier than ours.
Yeah.
It does feel like sort of, you know, almost like professional sort of teasing kind of thing,
right,
rather than being like buddies, which, you know, obviously they become more sort of like emotionally connected as time goes on. Maybe Scully helps to contribute to that in her own special way,
yeah,
as well.
Absolutely.
But I think that, you know, certainly the setup of the Lone Gunman, their characters, their costumes, everything is very set right from mm-hmm. the beginning.
Yep.
Does not change much. They look pretty much exactly the same in season 9 as they do in season 1, to their credit.
Yeah, they really do.
It's all right there from the beginning. And I also love the fact that from the beginning, Scully's not afraid to sort of question them and get right in there. She's not like, oh, this is the boys' club, I have to sit in the corner. She's getting right in there, questioning
yeah.
their theories, you know, having some, you know, fun banter with them. And it makes her all the hotter to
yeah.
Frohickey for it.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring that up because obviously the thing everyone remembers about this scene is the fact that Frohickey calls her hot.
Yeah.
And Scully makes a face kind of like a, what was this guy? And then later when she, you know, demonstrates that, hey, I'm more than just hot. I have,
yeah.
I know what I'm talking about. He then says, she is hot. And it's almost like, I feel like it's not undoing what he said, but it's like, it's kind of saying, okay, what I said before didn't really matter. Now I know that
yeah.
what the important stuff I've seen. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. It's like, you know, it's one thing to be sort of hot as in like, you know, surface hot, but now we're talking real hot.
Yeah.
She's like smart and she's, you know, willing to give us some shit. So that's real hot.
Frohickey, I have to his credit, I have to say, went from like crush to full on head over heels in love within 30 seconds. And I think
right.
And you see it right here. And it's so funny because I love the idea that, like, you know, that's never going to happen. Like, you know, and I mean, even from Mulder's reaction, settle down, Frohickey. Like, you get it.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, this is never going to be anything that's going to happen. But it is a cute thing that they keep referencing back to over and over throughout the show.
Yeah.
He's very open about it too. Like later, he comes to the hospital with like the flowers and he's wearing his tuxedo and he's just like, he's all about Scully. He's like, I am here to court. Even though she has no clue, she's in a coma, I am courting
yeah.
Scully. And I mean, I
yeah.
just,
so he's sweet. And you know,
yeah.
he probably knows he doesn't have a shot either, but he doesn't care.
Yeah.
He still loves her and he's
yep.
going to treat her right.
Yep.
And he's very cute. I mean, I love all the Lone Gunmen. They're my just my little pals. I want to put them in my pocket. pocket and carry them around with me.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, it's a great introductory scene, and very, like you said, I mean, we can say the same with Mulder and Scully. A lot of shows don't get this right, but they get they know these characters right off the top. They know them, and they don't change. Like at least not in a way that they're not allowed to change. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They are who they are. They're set from the beginning. And I think it's a great introductory scene for them.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, these are the Lone Gunmen. They're very recognizable as the Lone Gunmen right from the beginning. And, you know, the way they're performed, the way they're written, it's great. And it's another reason why EPE is an awesome episode. It's just like, throw the Lone Gunmen in there. Hello. I mean, no wonder it's like one of my faves.
Yeah. So we'll get back into the plot here a little bit. The this is the first time I think Mulder. I mean, I don't want to say it's the first time. I don't have in my brain what other episodes came before this in terms of what happened with Scully and when she believes what. But I do feel like I said before, this is a huge turning point in their relationship, in their partnership, I should say, because she starts to realize. It's like she sees the surveillance equipment. Like she knows something's happening. Mm-hmm. She can see it with her own eyes. And she's like, okay, why are we being bugged? Something is going on. Like we don't, this isn't just nothing. And I mean, I feel like the same sort of thing happens later in Erlenmeyer Flask when she's trying to sort of put Mulder off the trail, not put him off the trail, but be like, look, this is nothing, give up. And then later finding out, oh, you were right. I shouldn't have done that. And I feel like it's similar here, but not as big of a thing, because she does tell him like halfway through the episode when they're in the apartment and they're finding all the surveillance equipment, she does say to him, I think this time you're right. Like,
yeah, that's the turning point right there for that. That line for me is like not just the turning point for her in this episode, but maybe the turning point for Scully in the whole of season one to a certain extent. That's the moment where she is like actually fully on board with what Mulder's doing. You know, she's still going to question it, but she's open to it, like the most open she's ever been. And I love that moment.
Yeah, it's a great moment. And I was wondering what you think in terms of the surveillance. Like, for the first time ever, it kind of occurred to me that like the only one who has been in Mulder's apartment was Deep Throat. So I was like, who is actually putting the surveillance equipment? I mean, I don't think Deep Throat is doing it, because why would he be doing it? But it made me think.
He doesn't have to.
Yeah, it made me wonder.
It's a good question. I mean, I'd always just assume someone had broken in. One of the mysterious, murky forces of the government that I guess have nothing better to do than to listen to Mulder and Scully all day long. I mean, I would too, I suppose.
Right.
That'd be a pretty sweet gig. I mean, I guess we know now that Reggie did it later on, but he wasn't doing it yet.
Right.
But yeah, I always thought there's just some murky sort of, you know, black ops type people that broke into Mulder's apartment and just put stuff in, because that's just the kind of crazy shit that went on in Mulder and Scully's life.
Right. And we know as the series continues that they keep getting bugged and they keep discovering that they're being bugged. So, I mean, it's something that they can't really... They don't really have.
It's an ongoing
thing. They can't really protect themselves from it. I mean, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Right? I mean,
what are you going to do? You can't tear your apartment apart every
day. I mean, come on. Poor Mulder would have to get a cleaning lady, and then the cleaning lady would quit after a week. And
the cleaning lady would turn out to have bugged the apartment, and then you're screwed all over. And then, I mean, you can't spend all that money on like multiple flights to try to throw people off your trail.
Yeah.
You can't keep doing that on a daily basis, so you just have to kind of get used to it. But I think the whole bugging thing is, very sort of like, you know, on the nose in terms of the kind of things people were afraid of. I mean, today it's more about being hacked and that kind of sort of invasion of privacy. But, you know, the idea that, you know, people were listening was like a huge sort of paranoia thing back in those days. And so I remember being like super freaked out when Scully opens up the pen and finds the bug inside. I still to this day, when I see that, I'm like, oh my God, what is that? And so it freaks me out.
Let's talk about that, because I was always wondering, like, how did that happen? Like, how did she get that pen? Because doesn't that random woman hand her the pen
at the car rental, right? That's I think we're supposed to look back upon that and say, oh, that woman at the car rental agency.
Somebody told her.
Gave her the bugged pen. Yeah. But like, how did the government know where she was going to be and when? And how did she know for sure that that this whole pen thing would work?
It makes me totally think of One Breath, when Mulder's at the hospital and there's that woman who's like, got any cigarettes? Or you got a dollar for the cigarette machine? And then she's like, not my brand. And she like walks away. And every time I watch that, I'm like, what the fuck was that? And then I realize, she's trying to get in to look in the machine because he left. But like, who is she? Who is this lady? Like, did the smoking man find this lady and be like, okay, here's $20. Go up to find
exactly
the hot guy.
Yeah.
I don't get it unless this lady
and
is like
say, not my brand.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I like it. I do think it's funny and I like it because it's very like covert, like, you know, sneaky, and it's very cinematic, you know.
Yeah,
it's, but I mean, when you think about it too hard, you're like, okay, what's actually happening? So okay,
it
so
seems this, unnecessarily complicated. And plus, like, the woman in the car rental agency, she's even got like a kid with her, so just sort of like help with her cover, I guess. It seems like they're going to great lengths when surely it would have been easier just to bust into their offices in the FBI and get something in there. I mean, I know it's the FBI, but it's got to be easier than trying to do this random rental car agency thing.
It does make me wonder, like, what, like, because I don't know. It baffles my mind. I've thought about this for years and years and years and years, and I'm like, how did they get that pen into her purse? Unless you could have even just assumed somebody like slipped it into her purse. You know, why did they have to have the whole exchanging of the pens moment?
Yeah,
like,
can I borrow your pen? Yeah,
it's just bizarre. Anyway, I will think about this forever. I'm just saying.
I think it works really well because I remember the first probably couple of times I watched it, I really genuinely didn't think anything of that exchange in the rental car agency.
Right.
I mean, probably if I'd been a little more with it, I might have thought, what's going on here? There's something going on with this pen, I bet.
Right.
But at the time, it didn't occur to me that there's anything suspicious happening here. But yet, when you see the pen, you can think back and think,
and
it's from the car rental place. So it works on that level.
Jen, it's two women talking about a pen and not a man. And so this episode passes the Bechdel test. Right?
It does. A pen counts, right?
A pen is not a man. So
yes. Well, yes. It sure does.
That,
it
we need a shirt that says pen, not men. And nobody will understand. Can you imagine trying to explain that? So well, this episode of X-Files, episode 17, there's this part. Oh my God. People would be like, this person is certifiable. Oh my God. I love it.
I don't care. I'm totally going to put it up on Redbubble, available very soon. Some kind of a design that's going to say pen, not men. And it's going to have some kind of an image that somehow conveys this woman and Scully at the car rental place.
I love it.
Trading pens. And you and I will buy it and maybe some of our listeners. And we will all find it hilarious.
I do like it because I feel like pen not men sounds like some sort of Me Too movement hashtag in terms of like how sad it is that we have to look for these scenes in movies now in order to pass the Bechdel test. Like,
it really is. We're reduced to it being a pen.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what?
And for those that don't know the test, very quick description.
Oh, yes.
To pass the test, you have to have two female characters having a conversation that's not about a man.
Yes.
And so in this case, it was about a pen.
Yes.
So in that case, it passes it.
Oh,
but I'll tell you, when we get to the Erlenmeyer flask,
yes,
it passes it with
flying colors, yes.
Not just about a pen in that case.
Right, right. And I did want to bring that up later.
I'm going to put that on Redbubble.
Oh my God, I love it. I didn't plan to bring up the Bechdel test on EBE, I got to tell you, but I'm really glad I did.
Yeah. So am I. It was hilarious.
Anyway, all right, moving along. Let's talk about Deep Throat a little bit because we have...
Oh, yeah.
This is the first time that... Is this the first time Scully's aware of Deep Throat?
Yeah,
because,
this is the first time that Mulder mentions him, and I like the fact that right away Scully says, I want to know all about him. That's the first thing she says.
Yeah.
Like I like the fact that she assumes that she has the right to know this and that Mulder will trust her enough to tell her and that this is where their partnership is at right now, that she has the right to know this stuff and she's in it. And as soon as he starts to tell her about Deep Throat, it does sort of change the nature of the relationship a little bit because she's a part of that now. So instead of having him come up with weird lies about watching movies like he did in Eve to go off and meet with Deep Throat, now she is part of that circle. And it's just one more part of Mulder's life that she is now a part of.
And it is interesting to note, too, that like when we were talking about Eve, and that was like, what, episode 10? So it's like 7 episodes ago, something like that. Maybe even before. I don't know. Doesn't matter. We were talking about how Mulder, it seemed like Mulder didn't want to Or was trying not to tell Scully because of Deep Throat's wishes, like kind of sort of keep, don't tell her, don't let her follow you, don't tell her about this. And it seems here like he sort of gives her the information willingly, which I like, because it's like, look, she's asking about this. I'm not going to lie to my partner. I like that. And like he's put into this position where he has to say, I got it from a source. I'm really not supposed to reveal my sources, but it's a source. Like, and she's then suddenly, like you said, there's a third party here. I have a right to know, you know? So
I think the whole Deep Throat sort of presence in this episode has a big impact on Mulder and Scully's relationship.
Yeah.
As it also does in the Erlenmeyer flask as well.
Yes.
And Scully's awareness of him changes their relationship quite a bit. And the fact that she knows about him now, and the fact, I mean, and it leads, of course, to my favorite line of the episode where Scully says to Mulder, you're the only one I trust.
Yeah.
Because Mulder says he trusts Deep Throat and Scully has no reason to. But of course, gorgeously delivered by Gillian Anderson, it sounds like a declaration of love. And I just love that line because it's the X-Files. And if you trust someone, that's tantamount to saying you're in love with them. And so I love that line, and I love that whole scene and that whole sort of revelation about Deep Throat and the sort of the way it changes their relationship. And it's just hot.
I like that. And that has a good scene. It's later that they have the nice sort of really intense eye fucking moment. That's later in this episode. But yeah, this one's got a lot of good stuff.
Though.
Yes.
There's a lot of good MSR in EBE. I mean, EBE is a great Myth Arc episode, great UFO episode, but I have in the past underestimated how awesome the MSR is in EBE as well, because it's hot and high level.
You know, your favorite scene is that one. My actual favorite scene from this is the one at Scully's apartment when they're going over the photo. When she, because I feel like it's the first time she's sort of telling Mulder what she thinks of him. And it's not it's not non-complimentary in any way, shape, or form. Like, she's telling him, she's telling him, like, look, these are she's saying that you're having like a shortcoming, like just what she's telling him in a way. But she's also saying, like, where other people are going to see this as a weakness, I see it as a strength. Like, you need to, like, essentially, you need me. You need somebody to be able to direct you and rein you in, exactly what she's there for. And that was my favorite line in this one, is when she says the truth is out there, but so are lies. Because that's something that Mulder needs to hear. You know what I mean? Every time I watch this scene, it makes me wonder if he hears her. Because you wonder in that moment if he hears her, but then only a couple scenes later, when he finds out the photo, in fact, is a fake, and he can trust her judgment, and he does know that she was right. You see him hearing her, and I like that.
Yes, and we know that he actually had the photo checked, and so even though when he leaves her apartment, it does kind of, I mean, all he says is this very sort of neutral thank you and walks out the door. But we know that after that, so we're not really sure if he's actually heard her. I'm left with the impression that, like, he's just like, whatever, chick. But then we do find out that he went and got the photo check. So it must have sunk in on some level that he does respect Scully's opinion. And he's quite freely admitting of that, too, in the next scene that they're together. He doesn't, you know, try to hide the outcome or anything. He's very upfront with her and said, yep, you're right. It's a fake. They don't have any, there's not a lingering tension over that.
It's like the quickest sort of Mulder evolution that we have ever seen and might ever see again.
It was great.
But yeah, it was very nice. And I mean, again, it's really goes to show the trust and how they listen to each other and how they hear each other. And I think that that's so important, especially so early on. So it's a really nice scene. It's a nice scene. There's a lot of great quotes in this. I mean, a lot of the Deep Throat quotes are great, like, a lie is most convincingly hidden between two truths. Oh, is
love
a big
that.
One.
I use that one as often as I can in my everyday life. It just was, and it makes me sound super profound, and I'm all like, it's from the X-Files.
And it works, probably.
I get a kick out of any time I can use a line from the X-Files. Yeah. No one ever knows I'm doing it, but it makes me happy.
I also like when a shark stops swimming, it will die. If a shark stops swimming, it will die. I mean, I think that's such a great metaphor for Mulder.
Yeah.
And it's very prophetic.
Yeah, it really is.
I love this scene of them in the aquarium. Is there an aquarium? I mean, I'm assuming this aquarium was in Vancouver, but like, is there an aquarium? I mean,
there is like a big aquarium in Vancouver. I don't know if that's, I don't know if there's more than one aquarium, but I know there's at least one. And so.
And I'm wondering which aquarium it's supposed to be in DC. Like,
I don't know. Does every city have an aquarium? I don't really know.
I want to hope
that they do. Seem like a pretty, we don't have one here in Edmonton, but that's okay. We just have penguins in the West Edmonton Mall, but that is a separate issue, not to do with EBE.
That's true. I mean, if penguins were in EBE, I mean, that would be the only possible way that this episode could be any better. So,
I mean, but I love the way that scene in the aquarium is shot. It's very sort of the lighting is fantastic, and I always love scenes between Deep Throat and Mulder. You know, they both play really well off of each other, and it's always really interesting. Deep Throat, I always love Deep Throat, and we do. He is an interesting part of this episode, and we learn more about him as the episode goes on. We learn more about his background, and he seems a little bit more fleshed out as a character, as much as Deep Throat ever really becomes. And considering he's a guy that has no name,
he does have a name. We just don't learn it until much later.
We just don't. Yeah, exactly. But he's a really key part of this episode, and he's not just a guy that just shows up, sort of deus ex machina, here's some information. He actually has a role to play in the episode as it goes on, and so that's, I find that really interesting as well.
Yeah, I feel like this is where it really kind of upped his ante, so to speak. Like, before he was just kind of there. Like, he was just kind of there as a helper. He was like almost like a thing that was pushing them along, like not really a character. And like you said, like, here you find out more about him, and you learn, I mean, then stuff that definitely tracks. I know we'll talk about that too.
We might as well
talk about like he, you know, he tells Mulder that he was the one who exterminates the EBE and that's kind of what turned him, because he felt guilty because he essentially was committed murder, you know. And I think that that's a really, really cool tie-in to the revival. I'm sure you thought about this in My Struggle One, when we see the whole flashback of Roswell. We see this happen. We see the crash. We see the EBE get executed. I mean, this is obviously a different EBE, because Deep Throat executes one, I think, like in 91, like pretty more recently, obviously, when he decides to like defect.
World War II.
But I mean, the fact that you hear about this as a thing that happened, as something that has been established in season one as having happened, that like all the countries got together and they agreed that, hey, if a UFO crashes in your country, you are responsible for exterminating the EBE. This was something everyone agreed upon. The fact that they then call back to that in season 10 is so cool to me. I mean, then you actually get to see it, because they now have CG and they can let us see it, which was really, really cool to see, and a nice little bit of continuity, I'm going to say.
It was. Let's go with call it continuity, and the way it plays out in season 10 looks a lot like the way I imagined the story, the scene playing out, the way Deep Throat describes it, with kind of, you know, this alien sort of just looking with these sort of blank expression and sort of a certain almost like innocent expression about that you almost feel sorry for it. So, of course, the person who's present to witness that in My Struggle One becomes briefly an informant of Mulder as well. So there's that connection too. So there's that some parallels there.
Yeah. A lot of cool little parallels.
We like parallels. Yeah.
I love parallels.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, did you get the idea? Oh, real quick. I just wanted to bring this up just because I wrote it down and we were talking about the aquarium. I love the idea that Mulder doesn't have a fish tank yet. And yet we have this scene.
Does he not?
No, he does not have a fish tank yet. And we have this scene in the aquarium where we're talking about the shark swimming and everything. I feel like there's a lot of like fan lore about how Mulder gets the fish tank and when and why. And I just wanted to point that out, because I think the first time we see it is in Little Green Men. I think that's the first time.
Now that I think about it. Yeah, I forgot that it was that late.
Yeah, I don't quote me on that, because I'm not 100% certain. And we'll find out as we continue. But
I think so, yeah. But I agree with you. I think that's when it was.
But yeah, I think I think that's really cool because you wonder, when did he get the tank? And then the whole thing that they were talking about the tank, and they're standing in front of the tank, and then Mulder has no fish tank, but then suddenly he has a fish tank. It's just, it's cool. I don't know. I mean, and I don't know why he suddenly has a fish tank. Like, why? It's not like it was something that they have established. Yeah. It's not something he always had. Yeah, and they never talk about it.
It is a bit strange.
Right?
It always seemed like a bit of an odd sort of fit that Mulder has a fish tank.
Yeah.
It's like,
I mean,
why?
It is such a cool little character thing. I don't know what it means, but I love it.
It's something that it's not necessary, but it's cool. So that's its lack of necessity is what makes it cool. And it's, you know, it just looks cool in shots too. The lighting on the tank and stuff is cool. So
yeah, I think maybe it was a practical decision. Like maybe they were like, it's too fucking dark in Mulder's apartment. We need a light source that's really cool.
Yeah.
That's not like a lamp. And then that was somebody like a fish tank. I'm like, oh, that's the best idea ever.
Yeah,
I would be very interested to know.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that was it.
Yeah,
because it does look good. It does look kind of cool, and it does kind of help to kind of. Just kind of established this is Mulder's place, and he does have a few sort of things that make it Mulder-y. It's not just sort of impersonal furniture and things like that. It does look like his place. So
yeah.
The fish make it Mulder's place.
Yeah, I love it.
Wow, didn't know we were going to be talking about the fish today, but I'm glad we did.
Yeah, I love it. I like the idea that they're following this truck, this blank truck. It gives me Fight the Future vibes. You know, like tanker trucks. Like I can be Gillian Anderson and not be able to say that. Phantom tanker trucks. She was like tankum trucks.
Say.
I can't say it.
It's hard to say.
Yeah, it's very hard to say. But anyway, I did wanted to point out too. I don't have a whole lot more to say about this one, but I do think it's interesting that Scully seems to give Mulder like zero pushback when they decide to break into this facility. Like it's sudden.
She's up for it.
She is down to break in, and I just thought that was interesting. I mean, in an episode where she's. On board, you know what I mean? Like she's not
fully on board.
Yeah, she's not denying it. She's not, you know, and she's going with it. I mean, there's a certain point where she's like, okay, well, the rebel streak in me has ended, and I need to actually, I need to just be Scully now and say, hey, we can't do this anymore. We got to stop. We got to give ourselves up.
Fess up.
Yeah. And Mulder is like not having it and decides to just ditch her.
He's gonna keep going
with his terrible tie. I wrote in all caps here. Mulder's tie is terrible.
It's the worst.
It's so bad. I mean, it was like the one thing my husband commented on. When we were watching this. So he was like sitting and kind of watching. And he goes, "Oh my god!" He would not let it go either. He talked about it for like 2 minutes, and he was like, "God!" He was like, "They give Scully so much crap for her clothes, but look at that tie!" And he would not let it go. And I thought it was amazing.
I think it's his worst tie. I posted about that on Twitter, and I nominated it as Mulder's worst tie because really, it's like, what is happening?
It's the worst.
Tie? He's only wearing it in the last couple of scenes of the episode, but man, he saves the best for last because that is a hell of a tie.
It's really bad.
But yeah, and also. Shout out to Roger Cross, who's playing the guard in the military facility in this episode, who is also shows up in so many wonderful episodes. He's also sort of a law enforcement type person in Pusher. He's like the SWAT team leader. He's another kind of police officer in Folie à Deux, outside where the hostage event is happening. And of course, he's a police officer in Familiar in season 11. So I'm a tiny bit in love with Roger Cross, so I just wanted to say that because this is the first time we get to see him, and he's in a lot of great episodes, and he always does a great job, but I think he's cute. So just wanted to mention that, and yes, that is also a really tense and exciting scene as well. So yeah, Scully is down with it.
Yeah, I do like that. They're like, and the names on the tag were Tom Braidwood, of course.
Yes.
And then Val Stefoff. And I wonder who Val Stefoff is. But
yeah,
I did.
It must be somebody.
It's got to be somebody. But I liked the names, and I just liked how.
Yeah.
I just loved how down Scully was to like.
Totally.
Sneak into a government facility. This she's so new at this point. She's like, "Ooh, this is fun! I get to go break in with my partner. He's so cute and he's like, so dreamy."
Yeah. She's quite nervous about it, but it's like exciting at the same time. So yeah,
awesome.
That's another line from the X-Files that I quote at every opportunity. I don't know why it's a completely forgettable line when the guard says to them as he hands them their ID tag something like, "Display these at all times." And I say that to myself every time I go to any kind of a convention, any kind of a con, whenever they give me the badge, I always say, possibly out loud, "Display these at all times."
Oh my God.
Badges every time. I'm back at EBE every time.
That is so funny. Well,
I'm scared.
It's okay. We both are. Everyone's got their thing. I don't have a lot more to say about EB. I did want to bring up the scene at the beginning that we didn't talk about when Mulder and Scully, we first meet them in the woods, and he's doing his thing, and Scully's giving him right and left all these explanations, and he just keeps going, yeah. Possibly, conceivably, yeah. Feasibly. Like, it's such a well-written scene. It's
well-written and well-acted. I think it's a step too far when she brings up the swamp gas as a possibility. That's the point where it's like, swamp
what?
Gas?
Yeah.
I wrote down in my notes that it's like quite a buffet of what we used to call SREs. I don't think that's a term that's anywhere on the internet anymore, but back in the day on internet land, we used to refer to these as SREs, which was Scully rational explanations.
Oh, geez.
And so whatever sort of bizarre sort of theory she had to try to explain this stuff, it was an SRE. And there is one after another in that scene.
There is. I love the idea, too, that Scully's explanations, even while 100% more plausible, sound yes. weirder. And sound more bizarre. You know what I mean? Like the idea.
Sound lame.
It's like the idea. It's like so many layers. It's like even when you think about Byers saying, you know, that's why we like you, Mulder. Your ideas are even weirder than ours. It's like just when you think you've reached the weirdest explanation, then suddenly truth is stranger than fiction. You know what I mean? Like Scully's rational, plausible explanations sound less plausible. I also wanted.
They're also complex, and it's all like a house of cards. It's like,
yeah,
okay, there has to be a mountain lion and lightning. These other things have to be there for it to work.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in a way, it is like less plausible. But like in her mind, she's like, I just got to
do it.
Every avenue needs to be explored, and
it's good because it reestablishes at the start of that episode she's still a firm skeptic.
Yes,
and so that way, when she becomes less skeptical as the episode goes along, it has more impact. I mean, like by the end there, where they're having sort of that moment on the road where it seems as though there's been a UFO encounter and that the driver's missing from the truck, and Scully's, you know, she's asking Mulder, does this fit the profile? Mm-hmm. And she means like of an extraterrestrial encounter, and she's genuinely asking. So,
and he's actually saying no.
Like, and he's not.
Yeah, they're having a nice little role reversal there. And I mean, it is interesting, too, how the entire scene at the end, it's just, I mean, Mulder, of course, ditched Scully. And so it's his own fucking fault that she doesn't get to hear a damn thing that Deep Throat tells him. But again, we're in a position where Mulder gets to hear all of this stuff that he, of course, believes, and Scully doesn't get to see any of it. And so is then relegated to the position of where she began, to be like, okay, well, I thought all this stuff was leading somewhere, but it led nowhere. So we're back to the drawing board. And I feel like that's the push-pull of the show, and that's the way that they can sort of keep it fresh and keep you from getting that upset with Scully, because, hey, she wasn't there. She didn't see it. She didn't hear it. You know, I mean, she was giving him the benefit of the doubt, like, the entire episode.
She really was.
Yeah.
She really was.
Yeah, and I mean, she doesn't, like, I wouldn't say she necessarily backtracks, because I think she's learned a lot in this episode. And I mean, what we see in Erlenmeyer Flask, she's definitely becomes more and more willing to believe. With Scully, it's just about actually seeing. So which makes sense. And I think that's what's one of the cool things about how they are moving along with this mythology and the Scully arc. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is there's like quite a little arc for Scully right in this episode. So I love the way that played out. And it's very believable as well. So it's just a really tight little episode, I think. And the it's got a tight plot, a relatively simple plot by X-Files standards, even though there's lots of interesting elements to it. And there's lots going on with Scully. There's lots of MSR. It's a cool little episode, and I love it a lot. I think I had EBE as like number 5 in my all-time list of favorite episodes, and I would probably still put it pretty darn close to that, because I just have a lot of love in my heart for EBE.
Yeah, I remember it was definitely within your top 10. I don't remember if it was that high, but I remember it was in your top 10.
It was pretty high, because and it's one of those sort of, you know, early episodes that just has a special place in my heart and always will. And I could, it's just one of those ones, I just know it really, really well, because I watched it so many times back in the day, and I just love it. I love it very much. And there is like that really good eye-fucking scene, too, where after when Mulder realizes that they can't trust Deep Throat because of that they've discovered the photo is fake, and he says to Scully, now we're alone on this, which is kind of like, you know, earlier we have Scully saying, you know, you're the only one I trust. And that's Mulder to me saying, you're the only one I trust now, yeah. Scully, because he doesn't trust Deep Throat anymore. And so that's kind of like that's the X-Files in a nutshell. You know, it's always it's Mulder and Scully against the world. And I love that. And I love that. I love that about the episode.
Yeah. And then you're right. And that's the first time I think we really get a moment like that. So it's very important.
I think it is.
Very important. Very important episode for them and for the mythology. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I love it.
So moving right along, we are at the season one finale. Apologize for my dog barking constantly in the background.
He's just excited. And why not? These are great episodes.
He is very needy. but, you know, that's Apollo. So anyway, the Erlenmeyer flask is written by Chris Carter, who I think did a lot of the season openers and season finales. He didn't do Little Green Men, but he's done a lot of
He did most of them. Yeah. I think Little Green Men is one of the few exceptions.
Right. Directed by R.W. Goodwin, who I know that name a lot. He shows up a lot in the first early seasons.
He does. He does a lot of those kind of big, important episodes.
Yeah. And this is a very important episode.
Very important.
There are lots of things that are introduced in this episode that carry throughout the entire series. Unrelated to the mythology, I think this is the first time they changed the tagline to trust no one.
I think it is. Okay. Yeah, I'm inclined to think that that's the first time they changed it to anything, I think, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And it was like, boom, our minds were blown. We didn't know they were going to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, again, it makes me think that, like, even it's not the same because I know they changed the tagline quite a bit, but it does make me think of I Want to Lie at the end of season 11 or in the beginning of season 11 when it's like, trust no one. I want to lie. Hey, we don't know who to trust. We don't know what to believe. And I don't know if it's the first time, but Mulder is in a gray t-shirt. I have to bring that up.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's a really good point because he is in a gray t-shirt I don't think I remember seeing him in that.
I think it might be the first time. I really do.
That's
and
important.
If one of you Twitter folk, this is very important. If one of you Twitter folks out there knows that I'm wrong, please tell me. I want to know because I was just
you have to establish this.
Yeah, it was important. You don't see Mulder at his apartment lounging often. I feel like he's doing something important or he's sleeping. So
he's kind of sort of sleeping, but he was wearing a gray t-shirt and that is all that matters.
It's all that matters. All that matters. So we get a lot of establishers of the alien physiology, like the green blood. It's the first time we see that.
And the fact that it's toxic.
Toxic blood. The idea that the people with the alien DNA have this ability to breathe underwater. That carries all the way through to Jackson.
It's like that scene is so similar, isn't it? I'd forgotten how similar that scene is of
the Dr. head coming
Sicari
up out of the water.
Coming up out of the water when they sort of abandon the search for him.
Yep.
And boy, is that ever similar to that shot of William at the end of My Struggle For. I'd forgotten. I remember them as being quite similar, but they're almost identical. So that's very cool.
Yeah, it's just a nice, cool little callback. The idea that like these experiments have been going on like the entire time. Now obviously William is a different type of hybrid, but you know, the types of aliens evolve a lot throughout the series.
And they
have to do that because that's naturally, first of all, that's how you keep someone interested in a show. You got to make things kind of change and evolve and grow, but that's also like naturally how sort of science works.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
like
true. I mean, you have to think they made advancements and developments over
mutate,
like 25 years.
All kinds of things can change. I mean, it all comes back to this, and that's what's important. Yeah. I mean, and the title of this, the Erlenmeyer flask, is the alien DNA is in the Erlenmeyer flask. That's where this all started. That's where it all began. Yeah. She even says in it, I believe, that it was ancient. She says it may be ancient. I mean, God, she says it right here in season one, and then we get to see that in Fight the Future. So it's just a really, really cool thing that's like, hey, wow, that really does kind of line up there.
Yeah, I had forgotten how specifically they spoke about, you know, like alien human hybrids and alien viruses and things like that, that they really got into the nitty gritty of it in this episode. And we see, you know, the tanks with the humans growing in it and stuff like that, which is, you know, we see similar imagery like that in seasons to come. So I'd forgotten how much of this very specific stuff. I remembered the alien, the frozen baby alien fetus thing.
Yeah.
That is something you can never forget. But I'd forgotten about all these other sort of things, that Zeus storage and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot. There's a lot of.
Yeah.
There's a lot. This is a dense episode. There's a lot of stuff going on here.
Well, I mean, and if you think Zeus storage is the fact that Scully's baby is conceived at a place called Zeus Genetics, if you think that's a coincidence, it's not a coincidence.
Exactly.
This is all the same shit. This is all the same people that are doing this stuff. I mean, like, it's just and then you look to I think it's Piper Maru when they're talking about the downed plane or downed aircraft or whatever it was is called the Zeus Faber. And there's so much, that could be where the name came from, because that's like where they just, you know, it's possible that that's maybe where these people named it from. So
very interesting.
Yeah. It's just really, really cool.
It's very, very interesting.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot that they stuff in. I mean, considering this is like the season finale, mm-hmm. and a lot of shows maybe would just kind of wrap up the loose ends from the season in their finale, but they're just bringing in all kinds of new shit, which is really exciting and really interesting. And I think of this episode as really launching the mythology in its kind of modern-ish form. This is the episode I think that does that, because up until then, it's been sort of quite straightforward UFO episodes for the most part. But this is the episode that really gets into the whole alien-human hybrids, all that kind of stuff that's really going to form the majority of the mythology for the rest of the series, even increasingly so as the series goes on.
Yeah. I mean, this is talking about so many details about what the aliens are capable of, like the powers that they have, and then mm-hmm. the powers, you know, that the alien hybrids will then have, because they're the things that they're testing out. Obviously, some things aren't working. They're still in sort of a testing phase here. Like some of these guys, like, didn't they say that all the rest of the patients die, but this one guy survived?
Yeah.
And he's the one who's out there running around, and he's got all these crazy powers. I mean, they start talking about it right off the top. They talk about the healing properties that they have that we see, obviously, in the Alien Bounty Hunters, and then we see again in Jackson. He could just do it all. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of cool to be like, hey, okay, these are the properties that the aliens are going to have, and you're going to see them repeatedly in different forms. They're going to continue to come back in different forms, but there's always going to be this sort of underlying rule of what they're capable of doing, or what they can be capable of doing, you know? So I think that's
really
cool.
And where those abilities come from as well, that it comes from this sort of alien source, and that they're trying to splice it into a human. And that's that basic format carries through, and it's all set up here in quite a bit of detail, actually.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's really cool. I mean, Deep Throat gives us a lot of information, but before we get to Deep Throat, I wanted to say this is our first Syndicate member other than the Smoking Man. This is the first real Syndicate member. I mean, if we don't assume that, like, you know, Blevins is a Syndicate member yet, we don't know that yet, you know. Crew Cut Man is the guy who he's a familiar guy. I mean, a lot of people don't necessarily know him as Crew Cut Man. I don't even know what a crew cut is anymore, but I do know him as Crew Cut. And
that's been his official name, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to be the guy cleaning up. You know, he's cleaning up.
Well, he goes around killing people.
Yeah. He's like, this is not working, so we need to cover it up. Yeah. And then start over keep our
goes
shady
in
shit
and,
going.
Yeah, kills Dr. Berube, the scientist. And I think he's the one that kills Deep Throat as well. Or he's at least there.
Yes. Yeah, that is him. And the reason that I say that is because Scully recognizes him in season 2, Red Museum. I don't know if you remember this. Not only does she recognize the same guy because of that, and because of her abduction, probably. Maybe it's not from her abduction, maybe it's just because she does say, I think she says it's the guy who shot Deep Throat. I think she says that to Mulder in Red Museum. They even talk about in Red Museum, I mean, that's not even a freaking mythology episode, and they talk about the southern states that were inoculated with alien DNA when they inoculated all the kids. Deep Throat says that, and that happens in Red Museum. Like, it was just with the alien DNA, and that was that actually was kind of a somewhat mythology related
mythology-ish episode.
We will probably have to roll that one in, but
I think we should. I like that one. So
yeah, but I mean, again, just like the dumbest things like that you're never going to remember, but it connects. Yeah. Like it really does.
Yeah, it really. Yeah, there was just paying more attention to all the various sort of like info dump that Deep Throat was giving us. If I actually like put on my listening ears, I was like, oh wow, man, like this is all really interesting, cool, establishing stuff that they it obviously changes over the years, like you say, but they never really fully abandon it by any means. And if anything, it becomes a stronger foundation as the years go on, which I don't know what their plan was at that point. I don't know if they even knew they were going to get a season two at the time they were writing this.
Right.
And, but boy, they took those concepts and really ran with them.
And they built it upon
obviously they were
them.
Strong concepts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just added more and more layers to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about Scully and Dr. Carpenter, our real Bechdel test. Yes, I really enjoy this character. I enjoy their interactions.
Me too.
I'm super sad she got killed because I was like, we need more scenes with Scully, like talking to her doctor buddies. Like, I liked it a lot.
Like hang a note with the fellow female scientists.
Yeah.
Like I was so close to shipping those two. It was just like there was like a little scientist chemistry going on between them. Pardon the pun. And I liked. I was like devastated when she and her whole family were killed in a horrible car crash.
Oh,
it's like they couldn't have made it sound any worse.
And well, they didn't. Scully. You know, not. I mean, whatever. But they didn't say that the family got killed. To be fair, they said that she got killed. So let's say that the family survived because
okay,
we can.
Let's say that.
At least her family could have survived. But I did that they talked about. I mean, she and this is one of those things too that I find somewhat annoying sometimes in television shows. But I understand why they have to do it because Scully's obviously a scientist. She obviously knows all this shit that she's saying, but she has to explain it to her because she has to explain it to us. And so I do like the little sort of. They tried to make it seem a little bit more real, like, you know, you're a scientist, you know that this, blah, 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 but then she could say it.
But then she says it anyway.
Yeah, and then Scully can be like, like, as if, like, maybe, I don't remember that from my science class or whatever, but, like, you know that, like, Scully, you do forget. Scully's still rather young, you know, she's new to this, so maybe there are things, I mean, and I'm no scientist, so I don't know how basic this stuff is. It could be extremely basic. It could be, like, okay, Scully would know what she's talking about. It's fine. Because I know why they did it, but it does make me laugh because I'm like, Scully doesn't need to be told what a base pair is. She knows what a base pair is. But I do. Right. I just think it was fun. It was funny to see that. And I enjoyed it, even though I kind of have to roll my eyes. But I did want to bring up that Dr. Carpenter does start talking about the idea of mapping the entire human genome. And the fact that we find out that, like, all of this stuff, like, it ends up on the surface of the spacecraft, you know what I mean? Several seasons down the road. The idea that it could have possibly come from the aliens, I mean, that's not brought up here, but it's definitely the idea of that. Yeah, the idea of that and combining it with the alien DNA is just interesting that they are talking about it. Together.
Very cool. Yeah, because I think they say that's what Dr. Berube, the man with the monkeys, was working on the human genome project, I believe.
Yeah.
And so that's all part of this. We don't know in what way at all, but it's really interesting that comes up. And it's one of those things that's like, okay, I don't quite understand what this all means or how it all fits together, but we're not really meant to understand that yet.
Right.
But it's all intriguing and it was very cool.
Yeah. The idea too that Dr. Carpenter is like, you know, under normal circumstances, my first phone call would have been to the government. And Scully's like, what? Like, what did you find, girl? Because we are not caught with the government, even though I am the government. But you know what I mean?
That's so great. It's just like, those whole scenes, I mean, they could have been rather dull. They're mostly just sort of like, hey, let's all have a science lesson now.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that's the X-Files. There's a lot of science in the X-Files, and they always managed to make it interesting because they had a good actress playing Dr. Carpenter. They gave her good lines. It's well written, and they explain things pretty well. There's enough sort of visual assists for us to sort of understand what's going on, and it all kind of works. It's all really interesting, and I'm all like, ooh, what are they going to discover next? It's all quite suspenseful. It's like, ooh, I've never been so excited about what's going on under a microscope before. So it's very well done.
Exactly. And I do like the idea that Scully, when Dr. Carpenter, she's super excited. She's like, I could take a slice and crack these babies open. And Scully's like, I'll wait. And I'm like, these ladies just dig science and I dig it. Like, they're super into it. And I do love that. And even the idea that Scully is very willing to learn the truth. Like, she's not there thinking, well, I might find something that I'm not going to believe. Like, she wants to know. And I like that we continue to see that from her character, that she wants to know everything that there is to know. We should give a shout out. Anne DeSalvo plays Dr. Carpenter.
She's great.
She was great.
It's one of those, you know, it could have been a very non sort of role, but I love her, actually. Mm-hmm. I have a secret love for Dr. Crapper. So she just does a really good job with the pretty small role, but it just works really well. And it's all like, yeah, it's just like rah-rah science and let's learn. And it's very cool and very interesting. And it's a really compelling part of the show, actually. So I think they all do an amazing job with that. So we learn a lot. I learned a lot, I must say. Biology, not my strong suit in school. So I was all ears for all of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, me too. And I always enjoy listening to that sort of stuff, because then I feel like I can be like, oh, I'm a little bit smarter today.
Yeah, I feel smart. This is a smart show and I am smart for watching it.
Exactly.
So it's, yeah, there's always a lot of science on the X-Files. And like you say, Scully doesn't go into this with the idea of, haha, I'm going to prove Mulder wrong now. She just wants to know the truth. And she's quite delighted and intrigued to find out, hey, this could be extraterrestrial. This is like something we've never seen before. She's excited by that. She's not like, damn, now Mulder's going to rub this in my face.
She just
wants the truth. And she's just, all she wants is proof. And this is what she's getting.
This is funny to me too, because she gets probably more proof in this episode than she ever gets again. And yet it still isn't quite enough for her, which I know is again. And I mean, you have to forgive the show for this, because they don't know if they're getting probably another season. They don't know if they're going to go for 12, 13, 14, 15, however many years until, you know, they have no idea how long they're going to keep doing this. So it's like, okay, well, we got to give Scully something, you know? And then if we have to reel it back, we'll reel it back. And they do.
We've got her with the alien baby fetus. So, I mean, like, they showed us a lot. For, you know, sometimes we may think, oh, the X-Files never really showed us anything. They showed us really quite a lot, even in the first season. And, yeah, we sort of glossed over that slightly in seasons to come. But that's okay. You know what? It's worth it, because that's an awesome scene.
Well, because I think they realized, whoa, like, we can't show that much. You know, like, and so they had to reel it back. It makes me think of, like, same with the MSR. Like, we had the pilot where we're like, you're stripping down and he's touching your back and you got all this sexy stuff going on. Whoa, Nelly, we got a whole season. We got to reel this back. Like, I feel like it's the same sort of thing with the mythology. It's like, we can't give you this much. Like, we can't. Like, it's not that we don't want to. It's just, like, we can't do it. So
we've got to pace ourselves.
Yeah. Even the little missteps that they make, when you can look at that and you can say, like, hey, you know, Scully really, you know, come on, Scully. You have to forgive. Yeah. You have to forgive them that, because it's a TV show.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're just, it's a tricky line to walk of, you know, that's always the challenge with the X-Files, giving the audience enough while still holding enough back to keep us interested and to still have enough plot. And they never know how long that plot's going to have to last. So it must have been an incredible challenge for them to sort of figure out how to do that.
Right. And I do feel like, I mean, let's talk about Scully for a minute, because I do feel like in this episode, she has one of her bigger admissions. Like, she, that scene outside on the sidewalk when she admits that she should have listened to him, and she's super excited that this huge discovery could be happening, you know, and she's smiling from ear to ear. Like, she's thrilled about it, like you said. Yeah. And she does tell him that, like, look, you know, this is sort of throwing me for a loop, because I don't know what to believe now. I mean, this has always held. And then Mulder even tells her, you know, when we go into the room, it's not going to hold. And then they go into the room and there's nothing. So it's like, okay, she then has the ability to sort of, you know, give herself the benefit of the doubt back. Like, okay, maybe I was wrong about all of this stuff. My cats are being crazy. Oh my gosh.
Your animals are just excited. I mean, Toby was super crazy here earlier this evening. I just feel like these episodes have the animals excited in a way not unlike Dr. Berube's monkeys were also very overexcited. Just talking about these things excites animals of all kinds from one end of North America to another. That's all I can say.
At least it's apropos, right?
It's very apropos. Scully, when I think that line from Scully, you know, I've always held science as sacred and now I don't know what to believe kind of thing. It is like a huge moment for her. And that could have been like that. You're right. She comes so close to like the point of no return right there.
Yeah.
And if they had gone into zoo storage and it had been full of those tanks, that might have been it.
Yeah.
End of the X-Files.
Yep.
Scully believes.
Yep.
There's always just that little thing held back. And Deep Throat is there instead. And it's the first time, I think, that Deep Throat actually meets Scully.
It is, and I think that's an interesting that you point that out, because I feel like she is. She's right on the edge, like she's about to fall over one way or the other.
Yep.
She already is very distrustful of Deep Throat, so she goes in, and suddenly Deep Throat is just tailing her all this stuff, blah, 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 yeah. blah, blah, blah. And so I think even at that point, she's just kind of like, I don't know if I believe this anymore, because
yeah.
this guy is not trustworthy. And so it's actually a really good... Yeah. And Deep Throat is not very friendly to her. I wanted to say that, because I know everybody kind of loves Deep Throat as a character, but I feel like I part of me wonders if he doesn't take Scully as seriously. And I don't know if this is a misogynistic thing that's coming out in me, but I just get the idea that he's kind of dismissive of her, and he's a little bit talking down to her in scenes. Did you feel that at all? Did you get that vibe?
I mean, it's really interesting what you're saying, because it fits in exactly with something that I noticed, which is when he meets her, he addresses her as Miss Scully.
Yeah.
Doesn't call her Agent Scully
right.
or even Dr. Scully, both of which would have been acceptable.
Right.
But Miss Scully, which is a little bit dismissive. And
it
it's
is.
Just an interesting. I mean, yes, he addresses Mulder as Mr. Mulder, but if you're going to use some, you know, proper titles, then okay, call her Dr. Scully then if you don't want to use the term agent. So yeah, it does fit in with a little bit of like, you know, just listen to me, little lady kind of thing. I almost kind of always wondered, I almost get a vibe that because we see in Deep Throat's relationship with Mulder in this episode, Mulder is perhaps more questioning of Deep Throat than we've ever seen him before this. And it does seem to come from Scully. You know, he talks to Scully a lot about Deep Throat in this episode. He's very open with her. They have some, you know, fairly fulsome arguments about what are Deep Throat's true motives, and Scully is very suspicious of him. And Mulder does start to sort of, you know, question Deep Throat a little bit about, you know, what have you ever really done for me kind of thing. You know, I've gone along, but you know, this has always been on your terms. And I think that Deep Throat's not used to Mulder talking to him that way. So I kind of wonder if Deep Throat thinks, I used to have Mulder under my thumb until Scully came along. And Scully sort of, now that she's involved in our dynamic, it used to just be me and Mulder before. And now Scully's involved and she's maybe making Mulder mistrustful of me.
Yeah.
And it's almost like I don't know if I want to say he's a little bit jealous of Scully or resentful of her, that she's getting in on this dynamic that Deep Throat and Mulder have together. There's very much sort of almost like a father-son dynamic. You know, Mulder even refers to himself, I've been the dutiful son in this episode. And Deep Throat is kind of like, you know, you come in and you've messed up my relationship with my pretend son. And so I feel like maybe he's not a huge fan of Scully, maybe for that reason. And she is quite sort of, you know, openly critical, and she challenges him, but you know, that's Scully. That's what she does.
Yeah.
I think Deep Throat's not used to being challenged.
Exactly.
Perhaps.
Exactly. And so maybe it's more of a power thing than a misogyny thing.
I don't know. It could be a combination.
I think it's a combination, because I just assume that of old white men in the '90s that this is,
white men all the time.
Yeah. I mean, he's in the syndicate and he's surrounded by dudes all the time, and he probably just has this sort of thing. And you know, Scully is the one that if it weren't for Scully, Mulder would still be trusting, like you said, of Deep Throat. She's the one who found the photograph and was like, this is fake, dude.
That's right.
And he knows it. I mean, he even gets to her credit, to go back to EBE. He does point out, he's like, you and Scully are excellent investigators, you know, and I knew you were going to figure it out. Like, and so I don't think that he actually thinks that she's less than Mulder, but
no.
I do get the idea that the way he treats her comes off that way. And I don't know if that's just a directorial choice or an acting choice. I don't know what it is, but I don't know. In a couple of scenes, it rubbed me the wrong way. It was like, especially at the end when he's like, just give me the parcel. Just stay on it. Like, it was just kind of.
Yeah, don't try to question me. I think that they are just the wrong kind of personality types to go up against each other, because Mulder does tend to be a lot more trusting and a lot more accepting.
Mm-hmm.
And Scully goes around challenging everybody. Like we were saying in the EBE, she can't wait to get it right in there and mix it up with the lone gunman. And they don't mind that. They think it makes her hot. But Deep Throat is not used to being challenged, like I said. And so they just have their personalities conflict with one another. He doesn't like to be challenged. She loves to challenge. She's used to doing it. And for most people, sort of letting her, she believes that that's, you know, that's her role. That's what she's there for. And, you know, she does a great job of it. And so, but he doesn't appreciate that. So I think there's a little interpersonal conflict. I don't think that he disrespects her role necessarily, because when we hear, like you say, he says that when he's talking to Mulder and EB, you and Scully are good investigators.
Right.
He says to Scully, you know, at the end before the exchange, something like, you and Mulder are the only ones who can bring this to light, you and Mulder. So yeah, he obviously does recognize that she has an important role here, but I think they just don't get along that well.
Yeah.
They just rub each other the wrong way.
I think you're right. I feel like I see this so often now when I watch anything from the 90s that I'm on, like, I'm hyper aware of it.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I think that misogyny, you can never take it out of the equation. Anytime men and women are interacting, especially powerful men.
Yeah.
And I think that's always going to be an element, whether it's meant to be or not, it's always there.
I like the idea. I like the little bit in here when Mulder, he hears Scully talking about all of the stuff she's found and discovered, like all the science stuff that he needs. Like he needs her. And he has this moment where he tells her, keep up the good work. Mm-hmm. And you don't really hear that from him a lot. Like, I swear to God, I don't even know if you hear that again from him, anything
ever
like that from him until Fight the Future. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I wanted to point that out because I think that was an important little moment. And you can see from Scully's reaction that she kind of wanted to hear it. You know what I mean? And she just lives on those little crumbs that she gets from Mulder. Mm-hmm. It's about the Scully, you know, wanting the approval. It just goes to the heart of her character and the heart of her relationship. And I really think that's neat.
It really struck me because that is unusual for him to say something like that. It stood out to my ears as well.
Yeah. It was just very cute. I was just like, oh, Mulder, you're being cute.
Yeah.
I did want to point out another parallel, since we like parallels.
Yeah,
the
we
idea
do.
That Deep Throat says to Mulder and Scully as before he walks away, Roswell was a smokescreen. And that's word for word the same thing that doctor says to Mulder in My Struggle One.
Oh, yeah, he does. I knew that phrase sounded familiar and I couldn't quite place it. That's exactly where I've heard it before.
Yeah, so a lot of parallels with Erlen Meyer Flask and My Struggle One.
There really are, which is interesting. Because, you know, they're so far apart in terms of, you know, the time of when they aired, but they do cover a lot of similar topics and in really interestingly similar ways, but just also key differences.
Kind of reminding you that, like, hey, just because this isn't necessarily where we're taking the plot, this stuff still existed and it still exists and it's still relevant. You know what I mean? And I like the idea that they chose to do that because it does give it a nice little... Just give it a nice little continuity, and I like that.
I love it, just because it just gives us that, you know, this universe still holds and it still exists and these things all matter and this is the X-Files world and we're still in it.
Absolutely.
I love all that stuff.
The place where she finds the alien fetus, which we call purity control, which again comes back again and again when we refer to the black oil. I mean, we'll talk about that in season 3, I believe. But Fort Marlene is where that is. And do you know, Jen, the other episode where we see Fort Marlene?
I do not.
Or where they are at Fort Marlene? Well, Jen, in the season 6, episode 1, Sun, Fort Marlene is where Scully and Mulder shower together.
Ah, yeah, it is. That's right. How did I forget that? I guess I was just too busy looking at their bodies.
I don't blame you. It's hard to keep track of pesky dialogue when they're
seriously. How can
names
I
names of places?
To?
But I did think that was a cool little connection.
That's
that
very
they,
good.
Yeah,
yeah.
That they get us back. I mean, that's obviously a different wing of it. It's like the decontamination area or whatever.
Decontamination wing. But can I just say this is why. If you are ever at anything where there's an X-Files quiz going on, just know, everyone, you want Annie on your team because she knows this shit better than anybody. You would win any pub quiz that had the X-Files as a topic.
I do not think that I do, but I do appreciate
that.
I'm
pretty sure you do. Yeah, oh God, I know now that I've said that, someone's going to challenge us, aren't they? They're going to challenge us to some kind of a quiz and I will do horribly and you will do really well.
That'll be fun though. We could do that sometime.
You'd be really good at it.
Well, you know, I have done a lot of research for this episode, so it's not things that I know off the top of my head, I have to say.
I'm still impressed.
All right. Well, I like to impress, so I'll take it. anyway, so I think, gosh, the only other thing I wanted to bring up about this episode, and then you can add whatever else you want to talk about, is the idea that this green blood, like we kind of see the effects of it for the first time here. Like Mulder himself is exposed to it.
Yes.
And it doesn't kill him, which I know that there are people that die from the exposure to the green blood, and there are people in, you know, in canon that don't. Like the what comes to my mind is the officer in Emily, Officer Kresge, yeah, who gets affected by it, and he obviously survives.
That's
so
right.
I don't know if this has to do with like the amount that you're exposed to or the distance from which you're exposed or what, but obviously it doesn't kill everyone, and I just wanted to point that out. We kind of get that here. So
Yeah, and that's okay. That's fine. I mean, gosh, the fact that there's green blood and it has some kind of a toxic effect on you is the fact that they even got that part of it.
That's 5 seasons
present
later
and accurate right here in season one. It's like, I'm not going to worry about whether it killed him or not, because they got so many of the other details absolutely the same as and consistent as we saw all the way through. So I'm perfectly happy with how they did it.
Yeah, same. I mean, I think it's pretty cool that we get to see that here, and it has, you know, similar effects. So
yeah, if you had just sort of asked me in an X-Files quiz, when does the green blood show up, I would have said something like season 3 or something like that. I keep forgetting it was around this early. So
yeah, because I don't
kudos
think
to them.
I don't think we see it again for a while, but yeah.
I don't think we do. That must be why I forgot about it. And at the time, I didn't realize how significant it would become, because it does become quite significant.
Yes.
And just like an important image that we see frequently. But and it was there. It was there from the beginning, just waiting to be used.
Absolutely. Then the smoking man again, just like the pilot. We see him putting the alien fetus into storage. Mm. And I think this is the first time we see that it's the Pentagon, or did we see that in the pilot?
I think we saw that in the pilot.
Okay, that it was the Pentagon.
I think we
okay.
do, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. So there's a lot of callbacks to the pilot in this sort of final scene, the final couple of scenes with, we see CSM in the Pentagon. You know, Mulder is waking Scully up with a phone call at 11:21. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of really like cool callbacks to the pilot. I just love the fact that the X-Files had this very sort of bookend, interesting, consistent arc from the pilot to Erlenmeyer Flask, and that they made all these like really interesting tiebacks to the pilot in the very final scene that, you know, we all remembered and was kind of like, oh my God, my head's exploding with excitement. And it was just really well done and just like really cool little details that, you know, just the 11:21, you don't have to have that in there, but it's just a very cool thing that, you know, I was very taken with at the time. Still am.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And it's that call, talking about that phone call from Mulder to Scully when he's talking about how the X-Files are being shut down. He's like so sad.
Oh
like,
my God.
He can barely talk. Like I'm watching it and I'm like, oh my, he's going to straight up start crying right now. Like what can possibly make Mulder cry? The X-Files getting shut down and okay. Well, his mother dying, that made him cry, and Scully dying. Those are like the only things that make him cry.
It. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Those are the three loves of his life right there.
Oh, and getting regressed in hypnosis, but that doesn't count because that's like a separate, that's like a separate.
No, I don't count
life.
That. No.
Yeah.
That's but
the
no,
only
he
other
is
time.
Like, he's so emotional and he seems a little ragey underneath too.
Yeah.
Like
Like
the way he says Skinner when.
Yeah. When Skinner.
Scully's like, who did you meet with kind of thing or something? And he's like, Skinner.
It was very accusatory. Yeah, like very petulant. I thought it was so
very
cute.
Petulant,
very funny. But I felt so
he's
bad
just
for him.
In such a mood.
It made me think of, and he probably also was wearing a gray t-shirt, or maybe it was a blue t-shirt. In
I
scene.
Feel like he's wearing a collared shirt maybe in that
maybe
scene.
He is. I could be remembering. I just
like
always
a dark blue one maybe, I want to say, because I'm assuming he's come back from the meeting maybe.
Yeah, at 11:21, but you know,
For some reason, I don't know why, but that's the way it is. That's the way the X-Files works.
But it makes me
think Scully's down to sleep, Mulder's off having a meeting.
Exactly. The end when the office gets burned and that's another time when he's just like shell shocked, like he's so upset.
Yeah.
It's not crying or rage, it's just numbness. And I feel like that's another interesting progression with Mulder in regards to like how the X-Files become so important to him, you know.
Mm. Yeah, so. And Scully has obviously a better understanding by the time we have the end roll around of how devastating this is for him. I mean, she's sort of at the end of the Erlenmeyer flash, he's sort of shocked.
Yeah.
And it's more like, oh, you know, shit's got real, but it's not so much. I don't get the sense she's like super worried for him.
No, no,
but she's
just
kind of baffled about what's going to happen next.
I think she is, but I think it's a progression, and it's a very clear progression, because in Erlenmeyer flask, she says, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
She says that. It's not what are we going to do. It's what are you going to do? And even Mulder's response is, well, I'm not going to stop. Like, it's very, very, this is him, this is me. And in the end, we have no words. We have just, I'm hugging you. And I get this. I'm in this with you. And I understand. It's like a totally different dynamic. It's really kind of cool when you think about how far they come in, like, what, that would be 4 years. So, but it's a very similar moment. Like,
it is
far more devastating in the end, but similar type of moment. So,
it just shows how different their relationship is at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Just very nice. I mean, as slow and sure, like we say, that they dole out the MSR, it is there and it progresses.
It's there.
And you can
definitely
see it.
And when you sort of compare two similar scenes like this over several seasons, you can definitely see the distinction and the progression, and it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to add in terms of the mythology arc of EBE or the Erlenmeyer flask?
Not a whole lot. I mean, EBE, one of my favorite episodes. Erlenmeyer flask is not generally one of my favorite episodes, but it is a very strong episode. And I mean, there's just a lot of information. It's like a really important episode to pay close attention to understand the mythology in the seasons to come, because so many important things get established in it. And it's a very cool episode as well. And I had written down my notes with regard to Deep Throat's final words. Of course, we all know he says, trust no one. And all I wrote down was poetic, but not very useful. Because when you think about like all the things he must know and all the things he's been holding back from Mulder because, you know, he doesn't want to get too into it. It's like, well, you got nothing to lose now, dude. Just say something like the UFO is in Nebraska. Like,
in
say
a
something.
Silo.
Yeah.
Here's say the key like, is underneath the doormat. Go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He must have a ton of like really key information that he could be giving at that moment. But instead, all he says is trust no one, which is, like I say, I mean, that's, you know, one of the mantras of the X-Files, and it's perfect. But thank you, because I was told to trust everybody.
Maybe even he doesn't know everything. And I mean, there are things that he can't even trust himself, and he doesn't want to like, he wants Mulder to sort of do it himself because he doesn't want to like send Mulder into danger unknowingly, probably. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And here I am completely justifying his ridiculous quote that is amazing, but ridiculous. But you're right. It's silly, but it is one of those things that
it's
just
great.
Like,
I mean, I remember, at the time it was like, oh my God, that's so great. We loved it. I don't know if that's the first time we really hear that phrase, trust no one, which of course is so fundamental to the X-Files.
Yeah.
I don't know if we hear that phrase prior to that. I think maybe that establishes it and it becomes
the tagline.
Yeah. And the tagline, obviously.
Yeah.
That's just like
cool in retrospect.
It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing at that point. Trust no one. It was all like, oh my God, so exciting. Mm-hmm. And it was very cool. It was a very cool thing. That's when it became like one of the main sort of phrases. Yeah. Associated with the X-Files that's when it all started, kind of with that episode and with that moment. So it was very cool, if not especially useful.
When you were talking about his last words and like how there's probably a million things he has to say, but he just, you know, says something dumb. It made me think, I don't know if you ever watched the show Reno 911, but there is a scene where there's one of the cops, his boyfriend is like this serial killer, believe it or not. It's a ridiculous comedy for anyone who hasn't watched it, but it's so funny. He was getting executed and they're literally like in the room and they're like, do you have any final words? And he's this ridiculous guy. He's funny. You know, it's a funny show. And he just can't think. He tries to tell a joke. He's like trying, and he can't get it out. And he's like, oh, fuck it. Let's just do this. And, like, and like, so he ends up saying that. It's just really funny. And then I think one of the bloopers, like his final words were like, Seacrest out.
Like, but I can imagine though, I mean, like anytime I'm put on the spot.
Yeah.
And, like,
what are you going to say?
Something really great. I can't even remember my own name at moments like that. And so I can imagine, like, if I was Deep Throat, I'd be like, oh my God, there's so much I could say right now, but you know what, I can't remember any of them all of a sudden, so I'm just gonna go with trust no one and we'll just hope that covers everything.
Or I have it in me to utter three words.
Yes.
And I can't say the UFO is, because then I'll die. So I don't have enough strength.
I'm just going to impart some philosophy that I hope will cover everything. And it probably does. You know, it's good. It's good advice. It's, you know, it's important.
Do you think that they killed off Deep Throat too soon?
No, because probably we wouldn't be so taken with him if he was around longer. I think that you're always better to kill off a character too soon than too late.
Yeah.
And if they brought him back in season two, who's to say whether that would have been too long? But I'm glad we didn't find out, because it made him he always remained a very mysterious, interesting character. And if we'd found out anything more about him, he probably would have become less mysterious and less interesting. So
that's
it's
true.
Probably for the best. I mean, I loved him. I feel like they could have done more with him, and I would have loved to see more of him. But like I say, you know, it's probably for the best, because he remains special to us forever. He's my favorite of all of Mulder's informants. And partly because that they left us wanting more, which is never a bad thing.
Right. I feel like you're right. Like, the next time, I mean, Matheson, I guess, is somewhat of an informant, and we get him in the next episode. But I feel like Mr. X is next, right? And we don't really get him until season three, I think. Maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe Anasazi. I'm trying to think of where Mr. X shows up. But we don't get him for some time. It's like Mulder is informantless for some time. And you're right. I think the more we learn, the more he sticks around, then the more that Mulder will learn, and then the quicker the show will come to an end. So they do need to get killed off. And then
it was a great way to end the season. Yeah. I mean, because here was this character that to us seemed like, you know, a major character and an important part of the show. Like,
has all the answers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How are we going to have the X-Files without Deep Throat? And he was becoming increasingly important. And now Scully's met him. He's part of this, you know, universe now. And it was a real shocker when he was shot. It's kind of like, holy crap, anything can happen now. Mm-hmm. Like, anyone can be killed off at any moment. And it just really was this amazing kind of shocker, and a great way to finish the season. So I thought it worked really well.
Well, I think that's a good way to end it, with a dead Deep Throat. R.I.P. Deep Throat. Thanks, you guys, for listening. And if you guys want to talk about the mythology, or let us know if anything we missed, because I'm sure we missed stuff, or anything that you know, you want to point out, let us know at XFD Podcast on Twitter. You can reach us there. And we will see you guys next time on another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye!